Imagine a world where a convicted criminal can run for the office of sheriff and be elected. Once upon a time, that was a reality in the state of Alabama. A time when the state was still frontier land and in its infancy. A time when corruption was so prevalent that no one even batted an eye. And so, in 1878, Sumner County elected a new sheriff, and his name was Stephen Renfro, a dashing man who was a smooth talker and could gain the trust of even the most skeptical. But Renfro was no saint. He was a deserter of the Confederate Army and had killed his brother-in-law before fleeing arrest. Why, Renfro was even an influential ranking member of the famed Ku Klux Klan. And all of this before being elected the high sheriff. And as wild as this story is, there is even more to be told about the outlaw, Stephen Renfro. This is his unbelievable story. Alabama's infamous outlaw sheriff, Stephen Renfro, was a man of many contradictions. He was smart, charismatic, and brave. He was a handsome, magnificent specimen who was regarded as a good citizen and a gentleman among the people. And yet, for all of his gentlemanly airs, Renfro was also cursed with a violent streak. An incurable penchant for taking risk. Soldier turned deserter, politician turned night rider, public servant turned public enemy. Stephen Renfro's dualistic nature earned him a lasting place in the folklore of crime. Born in 1843 to a modest yeoman farming family that settled in Butler County, Alabama, Renfro was fortunate enough to have access to education. But with a flair for the dramatic, he was moved by the powerful oratories of Alabama secessionist and inflammatory newspaper editorials as our country moved toward civil war. After secession, he enlisted in Captain E.Y. Hill's Jeff Davis Rangers, seeking action in five battles. He was wounded in 1862 at Seven Pines, and then in early in 1864, he deserted and returned home to help his family, as did many Confederate soldiers. Renfro then presumably spent time among the criminal bands of the deserters that acted as guerrilla forces, fighting sometimes with Confederate forces and sometimes against them, seizing food and fodder from the beleaguered civilians. But it was after the Civil War, financially broken residents in cotton-growing counties struggled to return their lives to order. An economy that had long depended on slave labor staggered under far different circumstances. These economic changes were compounded by a vastly new political climate where white Republicans, historically a sizable minority, took control with the help of northern carpetbaggers, some of whom relocated, in order to seize political power. And these new politicians did not cater to the local Democrats who were accustomed to power. Confederate soldiers returned home to a new world run by political officials who viewed them as traitors to the Union. Suffering from what we would call today post-traumatic stress, Renfro was at times unpredictable, a danger to those closest to him. He returned to his hometown of Butler County and married for the first time on September the 2nd, 1865, to Mary Shepherd. They shared their farmhouse with Mary's sister and her husband until July the 9th, 1867. That's when Stephen Renfro killed his brother-in-law with a double-barreled shotgun in a dispute over chickens. Fearing arrest, he fled west to Sumner County. Now, authorities issued a warrant and reward for Renfro's capture, but in the chaos of Reconstruction, the arrest was never made. In truth, it was fairly easy to get away with murder at that point in time. In Renfro's new Sumner County residence, there were many business opportunities for a strong-willed man, and there were, well, there were relatively few restraints of law. Impoverished by the loss of slave labor and angered by the new political regime, local Democrats began to feel that they had no control over their own destiny. Desperate for a leader who would stand up to Northern rule, citizens in Sumner County were willing to overlook a few character flaws for a man brave enough to take back control by whatever means necessary. And so in the late 1860s, the political landscape in Sumner County was tense and foreboding. As military occupation in the South had created a safe atmosphere for radical Republicans, it was those Republicans in Sumner County, which now included black voters, a majority of the population, and who were supported and directed by carpetbaggers and Southern scalawags. Registration in the spring of 1867 gave 3,671 blacks and a grand total of 957 whites the vote. Numerous Reconstruction Acts rendered former Confederates ineligible to vote, many of whom felt debased by the new government. Black citizens were making the adjustment to freedom and citizenship, but many whites could not accept the abrupt racial transition. In fact, one white citizen proclaimed, "If a Negro was to dispute my word, I wouldn't like to take it. I would not like to take it from a white man, but I would not be at all inclined to take it from a Negro." And that is the feeling prevalent here in this country. Now, it was this attitude was a constrained one compared to that of a militant minority, the Ku Klux Klan, that appeared in Sumner County in 1868. Stephen Renfro had become active in the Klan and soon began leading its raids during the cover of the night. Initially, many white citizens supported the Klan's presence, making Stephen Renfro something of a local hero. The Livingston Journal's editor wrote that the peaceable, honest, and upright citizen has never been molested by them, while rogues who take advantage of unsettled times to practice villainy and whom the law often fails to reach find no mercy at the hands of the Ku Klux. And it was under Renfro's direction the Klan's exploits began to move beyond intimidation and on to acts of arson and even murder. A majority of whites, embittered by what they considered the excesses of Reconstruction, saw the Klan, and by extension, Stephen Renfro himself, as an expression of resistance. And so the citizens justified the violence and hoped that a speedy restoration of home rule would end the terror. In fact, one local leader, dismissed Klan activities as sporadic eruptions growing out of the revolutionary times, and some native Southerners were outraged by these activities but felt unable to destroy the movement. Stamping out the Klan would inadvertently aid the radical Republicans, unthinkable to local Sumner County Democrats, and some Klan members withdrew from the group when violent acts escalated. But it was the younger, more truculent men who soon filled their positions. In response to Klan activities, the Alabama legislature passed two acts in late 1868 to suppress secret criminal organizations. But inefficient civil servants, the chaos of the times, and the general inability, and to be quite honest, unwillingness of some Alabamians to enforce the measures made them inoperative. And so the elections of 1868 firmly ensconced the radical Republicans in power, driving Renfro and the Klan into a year of feverish mayhem. But on one occasion, a group of over 60 men overran the Livingston jail to free a white Mississippian who had killed a black man near Livingston. And then again, on another occasion, a mob of 15 to 20 Klan members descended on the jail to remove a black man who had confessed to participating in the murder of a white man. They then shot him, not once but twice, and then hung him. In the summer of 1868, black citizens began withdrawing from Republican-sponsored groups such as the Union League out of fear for their lives. Many radical leaders and supporters were run out of town, and the notorious Stephen Renfro, captain of the Ku Klux Band of Sumner County, Alabama, was at the center of it all. Listening to true crime podcasts can make you question your safety and security. And what better way to protect yourself than with a safe room? And why stop there? Make your entire house a safe space from serial killers and zombies and tornadoes and hurricanes. You see, insulated concrete form homes built with Nadura not only offer great curb appeal, but are comfortable and strong and safe year-round. ICF foam block construction offers superior energy efficiency, occupant comfort, sound dampering, fire resistance, and disaster resilience for the life of your home. And for those of you in North Alabama, North Mississippi, and Southern Tennessee, it is simple as emailing our good friend Carlos at BC3 ICF Distributor, LLC. Located in Phil Campbell, Alabama, Carlos has everything you need to build a fortified home at a fraction of the cost of a traditional build. For more information about how Nadura ICF can provide you safety and security, email bc3.naduraicfdistributor@yahoo.com. Stephen Renfro's first wife died in 1868, and he soon remarried. He married Mary Sledge, whom he called Patty, the very next year. But his personal life did not seem to slow his Klan activities. In the late spring of 1869, Renfro and two other whites shot three black men in cold blood. County Solicitor Reuben Chapman Jr. called the crime the most malignant murders ever committed in this state. And during all of this action, Renfro gained social standing and a strong following. The terror of the Klan had brought staunch results. Notorious Republican leaders had fled the region, and by 1870, no more than 20 acknowledged Republicans remained in Sumner County. That year's elections turned the tide for the Democrats, and though the majority of the 4,000 voters registered in Sumner County were black, intimidation by the Klan and anger at Republican impotence against Democratic aggressors combined to oust the Republicans from office. And so in the face of such drastic results, Renfro's night-riding raids did not taint his reputation with the majority of the white citizens. In a time when heroes were few, Renfro, flawed as he was, seemed responsible for having restored democratic rule in the county, but his second wife did not live to see the full swell of Renfro's glory. For Patty, Renfro would pass away in July of 1871. Meanwhile, Republicans focused on the upcoming 1872 national election. In 1870 and 1871, the federal legislature passed enforcement acts, including a Klan Act, to crack down on white Southern violence. Congress created a bipartisan investigating body in which Democrats were interested in exposing Republican misrule, and Republicans wanted to impose the horrific acts of the Klan. And so when the committee came to the Sumner County Courthouse to hear testimony in the fall of 1871, Stephen Renfro was identified as a killer, but no charges were ever made. In early 1871, a black man accused of killing a white man was taken from the Livingston jail and, according to the sheriff, shot worse than any piece of flesh I ever saw. The above act was denounced through the community in the papers, but there was no public reprimand of the specific men involved, Renfro likely among them. But Klan members were growing weary of the increased presence of government soldiers, and local officials were anxious to quell Republican scrutiny. And though federal oversight was unwanted, and if the Klan was a cause of that oversight, the Klan's usefulness was at an end. By late 1871, the group ceased to have a recognizable presence in Alabama, with the Klan defanged and additional troops, election supervisors, and U.S. Marshals sent to observe the 1872 elections. Republican voters felt safe enough to vote against the Democrats and claim another victory. Jaded and without his night-riding posse, Renfro apparently left for Texas that year, but he would return to Livingston in 1873, and it was there that he would marry his third wife, Cherry Reynolds. But for Stephen Renfro, it wouldn't take long for him to manage to find trouble. On the evening of August the 1st, 1874, Walter Billings, a New York native running for the Alabama State Legislature on Sumner County's Republican ticket, was ambushed and killed. When a local hotel manager spread rumors of Renfro's involvement, Stephen Renfro assaulted the man in the street. Investigators were told by witnesses that Renfro was not the most quiet man in town, but he was the nicest. And so Stephen Renfro, they claimed, was just defending his own character. The Radical Republican paper had a different take on the fight. It claimed that certain parties in Livingston had actually bought Renfro a new coat as a pat on the back for thrashing the man. Thomas L. Ivey, a black radical Republican who was known for his aggressive speeches denouncing whites and Democrats, threatened to kill the man responsible for Billings' death. And soon after, Ivey was murdered by a group of as many as a dozen men. It was in the face of this violence that requests for action were sent to Washington. Republicans were still bitter about the 1870 election results, which were dramatically influenced by the Klan intimidation. People would not feel free to vote if opponents were being assassinated in broad daylight. Troops, as well as two disguised U.S. Marshals, a detective of the Post Office Department, and a government agent of the Treasury Department, were dispatched to Livingston in Sumner County to maintain order. Disguised, the detective and the Treasury agent rode into town in a mule-drawn carriage, or wagon, I should say, that carried tobacco, apple brandy, and whiskey, with a sign that read, "Tobacco and whiskey for sale here." The two told locals that they were Klan members from North Carolina, and talked up their exploits. Now, the Treasury agent talked less than the postal one for fear that the crowd would detect his Yankee twang. And after gathering information about the remnants of the local Klan from their customers, the agents worked with two disguised marshals to make a list of suspects. And so the marshals chose the Democratic Convention on September 28th to make their arrest. In front of 200 or 300 delegates, the officers walked in and announced warrants for 10 men. Stephen Renfro was included. Democrats felt the timing of the raid pointed to a political motive and claimed the officers had chosen to make the arrest at the convention in order to tarnish the party's image. In fact, the editor of the Democratic Journal painted a heroic portrait of the arrested men as brave martyrs for the cause. Republican papers saw the matter far differently, saying that the arrests were long overdue, and the Montgomery State Journal predicted Renfro will doubtless swing for his participation in the murder of Billings, if not for other crimes. Now, Cherry Renfro was due to deliver a baby any day and was hauled along with the other captives 300 miles away to Mobile to appear before U.S. Commissioner James Gillette. A largely Democratic town, Mobile greeted Renfro and the other prisoners as heroes, showering them with gifts, including underclothes and wine. The Southern draws ran thick as the hearing began on October the 6th, 1874, and one reporter wrote, "The attorneys for defense are Southern gentlemen of the old school. They say, 'I reckon,' and 'Where were you at?'" Renfro insisted that he was home when the Billings murder occurred, but he appeared more bored than innocent. A newspaper stated that Renfro sat through the trial without showing a single sign of emotion or even interest. He was committed without bail to await trial before the U.S. Circuit Court and held along with two others. It was from jail the three men issued a plea for white Democratic solidarity, urging white men to unloose the chains of your state by the overthrow of the Radical Party in November. Cherry delivered a healthy boy while Renfro was in jail, which just added to public sympathy for him. And while Renfro waited in jail, the 1874 elections gave Alabama Democrats their long-sought redemption. Many Americans, including the re-elected President Grant, seemed tired of Reconstruction and its endless controversies. In Mobile, where the prisoners were housed, boisterous Democrats serenaded Renfro in his cell after their victory at the polls. On November the 14th, Renfro was permitted to post bail, and over a dozen men raised money to help. He won even more supporters with his suggestion that funds donated to help defray recent expenses to his family be donated to the orphans' home at Lauderdale, Mississippi. One wonders what Cherry Renfro at home with the baby thought of her husband's generosity. Are you looking for unbiased news in a world of biased media? Look no further. 1440 provides an impartial view of what's happening in the world so our readers can form their own conclusions. 1440 scours hundreds of sources each and every day to bring you a single morning briefing thoughtfully curated by experts, straight to your email with no haggling or unnecessary spam. Get even more benefits by signing up through the Deuce Conrad Show affiliate link. Visit www.deuceconradshow.com and select promotions to sign up today. By 1876, the Republican Party had been more or less eliminated as a political force in Sumner County. As the dust of his violent exploits settled, Stephen Renfro found himself in high favor among the town locals. Now, not yet 35, his past actions had made him somewhat of a legend. As much as anyone, he was credited with redeeming the county from radical Republican control and restoring the peace. And it was at the peak of his popularity and unsuited for the sedate life of a farmer that Stephen Renfro decided to run for Livingston Sheriff in 1877. He won by a patriotic number, 1,776 to 1,179. Now, initially, the townspeople were delighted to have Renfro as the face of the law. He impressed them when he arrested four train-jumping gamblers, saw to their convictions, and handedly apprehended an escapee. But if Renfro's Klan exploits had made some citizens doubtful about his character, the praise he won as sheriff convinced most that he was now an upright man. But Renfro was more accustomed to breaking the law than upholding it. And so when the courthouse was robbed of $500 a few months later, an out-of-town newspaper report praised Renfro's efficient handling of the case. Though some who knew Renfro well suspected his involvement. And so suspicion spread as other crimes plagued the area. Eventually, even Stephen Renfro's friends were willing to speak up, including the editor of the Livingston Journal. So much so that he published Stephen Renfro's wrongdoings. Renfro committed robbery twice of his own office, drinking, arson, blackmails, thieving, and other almost inconceivable outrages. By the spring of 1880, town officials had no choice but to charge Stephen Renfro with assault, with intent to murder, embezzlement, conversion of funds as sheriff, and citations of negligent escape. Yet the dashing Renfro's charm and heroic status were such that many of his neighbors were willing to forgive and forget. A bail originally set at $500 was reduced to $300, and Renfro soon walked the streets again, and so he had escaped the consequences of his deeds so many times that, after all, he was slow to realize that his abuse of office might very likely be pardoned, but not be overlooked. When Democrats nominated a replacement for sheriff, Renfro was taken by surprise to find himself ousted. Fallen from his glory, he soon turned to drinking and fighting, and people who had silently applauded Stephen Renfro's defiance of Reconstruction authorities watched with horror the breakdown of a hero. And several of those who had secured his bail withdrew, and he was rearrested and committed to jail. With no further advantages to the ruse of respectability, Stephen Renfro became a bona fide outlaw. Using a smuggled pocket knife to create a crude saw out of silverware, of all things, he began cutting a 15 by 20 inch hole in his cell wall. On Saturday, June 19th, Stephen Renfro escaped from jail, taking six prisoners with him and leaving a note to his successor. Two prisoners refused to escape, but they were not rewarded for staying. In fact, one was later hung. By the summer, nothing more had been heard from Stephen Renfro, but it was in August of 1881 that the grand jury withdrew most of the charges against him, and, well, he kind of just slipped out of public consciousness. Had he been able to forget Livingston entirely, his wife, son, and former fame, Renfro might have remained free. But Stephen Renfro did make an attempt to move on. For the next year or so, rumors of his possible death and other far-fetched stories abounded. But, as always, he couldn't leave Sumner County alone, and he would return to the area late in 1882. And by 1883, he had worked up the courage to go to Cherry and plead for forgiveness. Now, it was his wild behavior that had estranged his wife from him completely, and so when he met with her in their former home, Cherry's brother stood by holding a shotgun and looking for some kind of redemption. Stephen Renfro then met with the city marshal for several hours. Still able to manipulate situations to suit his own needs, Stephen Renfro had little to no difficulty in convincing the marshal that he planned to surrender. And so no arrest was made. Friends took Renfro in, but at some point he realized that he could not return to the life he had once led. Severely depressed, he left the area briefly, but came back in the spring of 1884, once again determined to give himself up. Now, former admirers raised Renfro's bond, but his abuse of alcohol and fighting soon landed him back in jail. Knowing that redemption in Livingston was no longer possible, he was faced with the choice of being a tarnished, free fugitive or an imprisoned, disgraced hero. So he did what was natural. He chose the former. And after a failed escape attempt, he was transferred to a more secure Tuscaloosa prison. But even there, he took advantage of an opportunity to burn his way out of it in a rare example of an incendiary escape. But with his unusual flair, Renfro left the sheriff a condescending note and fed his supper to the jail yard dogs for a bark-free exit. And then, in true dashing fashion, as he only he could do, he convinced a black warrior ferryman to take him across a river. And so Renfro traveled through Sumner County, moving on to New Orleans, Texas, and even for a while, Mexico. But yet again, by the summer of 1885, Livingston was calling home. And he returned there to see his son. And when townsfolks discovered a bay horse, a saddle, and bridle had been stolen, they already knew Stephen Renfro had passed through, and it was a Birmingham detective that found and arrested the outlaw in Slidell, Louisiana. At his trial in the February of 1885, Renfro, now 42 years old, agreed to confess to grand larceny and embezzlement and serve 5 years in jail in exchange for various charges being dropped. Alabama, through the notorious convict lease system, leased prisoners to mining companies, and so Renfro was sent to the Pratt Mines near Birmingham. The Black Belt newspaper noted that the real question is how long will he remain in the clutches of the law? Well, the answer to that was not very long at all. Just a mere 2 months. Renfro would escape, and from there he reached Utah, 32 miles from Livingston, where he met up with a tramp. Renfro revealed his identity and begged the man to go into town to get him some food. The tramp instead went to the sheriff. And a capture party got within 20 feet of Renfro and opened fire. But miraculously, he got away again. And of all places, returned to Sumner County in the hopes of being protected by his former friends. But by now, the public had heard that the ex-sheriff was back in town, and they grew frightened and demanded his arrest. The Negro Baptist Church held an emergency prayer meeting at 3:20 a.m. as soon as they had learned of Renfro's return, sounding an alarm bell. Frank Herr, editor of the Livingston Journal, trekked through a swamp in October of 1885, hoping to interview Alabama's most notorious fugitive, his old friend, the disgraced ex-sheriff of Sumner County, Stephen Renfro. Herr and his reporters met an armed man as night was falling. Renfro's guard blew 3 times on an acorn whistle, and 1 faint whistle came back. The group walked about 15 minutes and signaled to each other again. Eventually, they found Stephen Renfro sitting on a log with a double-barrel shotgun in his lap and a Remington revolver on his belt. Renfro cannot be captured, the journal wrote, because but one person can see him at a time and no one man can take him. He has an impregnable position from which he could kill as many men and dogs as might come within reach of him. Now, that article outraged Justice Collins, the manager of convicts at the Pratt Mines, who soon turned his fury on the newspaper. And Louise Wooster. Now, she was a Birmingham madam who claimed to have once been John Wilkes Booth's lover and was a beloved citizen after she helped save the newborn Magic City, survive a cholera epidemic in 1873. Everyone who was sick, who could possibly leave the stricken little city, lost no time in getting away, she wrote in her memoir. Those who were too poor had not the means to go, those whose duty forbade them from fleeing the danger, and a few brave and noble ones who were not afraid to face danger were all of the well ones left behind. Now, she had the means to leave, and friends told her she would die if she stayed. Why I remained has always been a mystery to me, she wrote. I was determined to stay and help nurse the poor, sick, and suffering ones who needed me. So in the 1880s, Wooster bought a 2-story home on 4th Avenue North and an adjacent building that became one of Birmingham's high-class brothels, where she was said to have amassed a fortune. It was in 1885 she was in the crosshairs of the manhunt for Alabama's most notorious outlaw, Stephen Renfro. After his prison camp escape, Renfro went into Birmingham after leaving there for the purpose of finding the house of Lou Wooster, a woman of bad repute, with whom one Walter H. Wilson, formerly of Greene County, the state, had left a pistol for him. Collins wrote in a letter shared by multiple Alabama newspapers in November 1885. Wilson was a guard at the camp accused of hiding a stolen gun for Renfro at Wooster's house. There is absolutely no question but Walter H. Wilson, Lou Wooster, and other friends of Renfro, whom I do not know, will read the interview with feelings of unalloyed pleasure. But when it comes to be read by law-abiding citizens, it will be read with sadness and regret. Lou Wooster sent her response to the Birmingham Chronicle, "I think a great injustice has been done me, and I hope you will print what I have to say in vindication of myself. Justice Collins is either mistaken or maliciously did me an injustice." Louise says she met Wilson and took him to be a gentleman since he was a guard, but he asked her for food for the imprisoned Renfro, to which she agreed. She said, "I wouldn't refuse anyone that." And she said there was no talk of any escape, but said she and Wilson had discussed trying to get Renfro a pardon. The article continues, "Later in the evening, a lady in the house came to me with a pistol in her hand saying, 'Miss Lou, will you keep this? I'm afraid of it.' That man left it with me until he calls for it. He has two and says this one is so heavy he didn't want to bother with it. I was not supposed to know the gun was stolen, as I had no idea that thieves were employed as guards." Louise said Wilson later came back with another man, and she questioned him about the gun. She said she later learned the man with Wilson was an official of Pratt Mines. She said she was shocked to hear of the escape and that Wilson had left a stolen gun there for Renfro. "When I knew Renfro, he was a gentleman whose character was above reproach, and I never knew him after he was accused of crime. Though I had never known him, I could not refuse his appeal for something to eat. I believe my character for truthfulness and honesty can be substantiated by the good people of Birmingham."
Do you have a beard? It's a legitimate question. You know, a beard says a lot about a man. A beard can define a man just by looking at him. Screw what they say. You can judge a book by its cover, and a beard is one hell of a cover. But let me ask you this. How do you take care of your beard? Are you putting chemicals into your face that will basically eat the hide off of a zombie? Stop that shit. Be a badass and start using Badass Beard Care. Look, it's all natural. It's made by badass vets, and it will make your beard so incredibly soft, so incredibly manly. And you can get a free trial set today by going to deuceconrad.com and selecting Own Promotions.
Hiding out in the woods, Stephen Renfro survived on wild game and gifts from loyal friends. It was this solitary life that was miserable for him, but he couldn't abandon the area where he had known so much glory. In the spring of 1886, area horses began to go missing along with silver, as well as a mule belonging to Renfro's former brother-in-law. The former sheriff would be caught on July the 10th by three area farmers who fired a load of birdshot into his side and back. It was perhaps knowing that he was going to be lynched and wanting no further pain that Renfro neglected to have the 60-odd pieces of lead removed. On July the 13th at 5:20 a.m., a train brought Stephen Renfro into Livingston, where an angry crowd awaited him. Townsfolk purposely delayed until the farmers had gotten their reward for Stephen Renfro's capture before sending a small lynch party of eight to the jail. It was there that Stephen Renfro resigned himself to the group's wishes. Many townsfolk watched as the undisguised mob escorted Renfro south through town to an old tan yard on the bank of the the river at around 8:30 p.m. They led Stephen Renfro beneath a large chinaberry tree and placed a noose around his neck. When asked if he wanted to pray, Renfro answered, "Boys, you know I've never prayed in my life." Stephen Renfro was found hanging with a placard attached to his back that read, "The Fate of a Horse Thief." Though several people had seen Renfro's captors, no one would identify them. Squire Robert Tankersley summoned a jury of inquest that found that Renfro came to his death by hanging, which was done by persons unknown. His body was placed on a prison cot in the open hallways of the courthouse. There were no mourners, no burial in the town cemetery, and no funeral service. The former sheriff, the former legend, received a pauper's burial in an unmarked grave. Thus ends the career of the most daring, desperate character Alabama ever produced, one newspaper proclaimed. Louise Wooster retired at the turn of the century and died in 1913. Legends persist that empty carriages from customers unwilling to show their faces followed her casket to the graveyard, and that she was the inspiration for the character Belle Waddling from Gone with the Wind. The manner of Renfro's death only enhanced his already legendary status, and it was not long before local folk began telling mysterious stories about the hanging tree and how cattle would not rest under it and birds would not roost on its branches. The most spectacular tale described how Renfro's spirit returned astride a white horse named Death every July the 13th. Outside of the Black Belt, Renfro's name survived because of a national love affair with outlaws, men like Renfro and Jesse James, who strutted and fretted at a time when frontiers were closing and respectable conformity seemed inescapable. Carl Kammerer's 1934 classic, Stars Fell on Alabama, for example, presents Renfro riding into Livingston on a white horse. And for over a century, Renfro's deeds have exemplified important themes of Southern history, racial tension, and the persistence of violence and, resistance towards authority. Stephen Renfro's life continues to invoke a mixture of respect, sadness, but above all, curiosity. Sumner County native James Fuller decided to investigate a story passed down from his aunt. He said it was Stephen Renfro's second father-in-law, Mr. Sledge, who dug up his body a few days after his lynching and took it to the Old Side Cemetery to rebury it next to Renfro's first two wives. Visiting Old Side, James Fuller and his cousin Howard found an old broken headstone that marked the wives' graves in a depression that turned out on further investigation to be a third grave, Stephen Renfro's grave. Surely, by all principles of logic and folklore. And it was James Fuller that saw to the erection of a headstone for Stephen Renfro and to repair his wives' markers. Despite all of his crimes, Stephen Renfro's life embodied paradoxes that still intrigue us in the 21st century. Sheriff and outlaw, fortunate and tragic, detested and respected, his history is inevitably linked with the story of Sumner County and Livingston and is a testimony to the desperation and confusion that surrounded the Civil War and Reconstruction era. A time when truly hypocrisy and violence were overlooked if they led to the restoration of white control. But thanks to the skill and dedication of James Fuller and others, the legend of Alabama's outlaw sheriff seems bound to continue for generations to come. In a 2006 interview, Fuller aptly summed up Renfro's experience, saying that the one-time hero had faced the question of what separates murder and justice. But he got to the point that he couldn't distinguish the difference. Until next time, I'll see you then.